to this section. My name is Dan Lanstra. I'm a Bible teacher at Unity Christian. This year also I have a new position as well as a Bible teacher. I'm the Director of Spiritual Life and Leadership at Unity. After teaching there for 24 years, we created a different position to try to meet the needs of our kids in a different way through this position. One of the things I really have enjoyed doing over the years is talking with teachers, with parents, with churches, and different schools about the things that make our kids, and as children of God, and as image bearers of what is happening in their lives, what's happening in the world, what's happening in culture. So in 1 hour, there is no way that we will take care of the issue of, you know, iGen, social media, faith development. This is going to be a bit of an overview with some ideas, some suggestions, some opportunities maybe to think about some things in a way you haven't before. I love to, personally, other than the teaching in my classroom, I love to learn about the culture that our kids are in and try to understand them. And so part of that is to give you a glimpse into what I'm learning myself as I'm taking a look at, you know, high school for me in 2018-19. How many grade school teachers are in here this afternoon? Okay, how about middle school? How about high school? Okay, so great. We got a great mix. And I do want to ask the question. I just wonder, and this is not a bad thing. I'm just curious. How many of you, is there anybody in here who right now does actually, you do not have a phone on you right now? You do not. That's, okay, that's 2 out of about 185 today. So that's actually, that about fits. So, what I would like to do today, we'll get a little bit of an overview. Just to be clear, this is not a let's hate on technology session. Okay, this is not a what's wrong with our kids, terrible kids. It's not that kind of a session either. It's an understanding and an equipping and we have an opportunity as well. I really believe that Christian schools are sort of set up in a position now where they have a real opportunity given the things that are going on in our culture. So I always like to start with something scriptural. With anything that I do, and so this is a passage maybe a lot of you know, and I think this really fits with what we're trying to talk about in terms of culture and kids. So God has breathed life into all Scripture. It is useful for teaching what is true. So I'll stop for just a second and kind of highlight the word true there. That's going to be a focus a little bit of what we talk about is the idea of truth, because that has become a little more of a lost concept culturally as to what actually is capital T truth. So the Bible is useful for teaching what is actually true. It is useful for correcting our mistakes. It is useful for making our lives whole again. It is useful for training us to do what is right. By using Scripture, the servant of God can be completely prepared to do every good thing. So that's maybe a motto for us as we look at our kids. If you go back a chapter in 2 Timothy chapter 2, there's also a section about how to do that well, which is don't argue, don't quarrel, don't get caught up in things that are just going to lead to more problems. It's a really good passage as well, so you can read through 2 Timothy 2, 24 to 26, another good passage to think about. Maybe today you need this one in the middle of October, right? As you're, you know, in school since maybe mid-August for some of you. Don't burn out. Keep yourselves fueled and aflame. Be alert servants of the Master. Cheerfully expect it. Don't quit in hard times. Pray all the harder. As a teacher of, this feels a little weird to say this, but as a teacher of 26 years, I don't think teaching is really getting easier over the years. I remember graduating from Dort back in 1992, and when I was a senior, just before I started student teaching, they brought into an ed class that I had some first-year teachers from the one from the local high school, a couple from the grade school, and I was like, oh, you guys are so smart. First-year teachers, you guys, wow. I just couldn't believe it. Like, these guys have like this wealth of knowledge, first-year teachers. And when I saw a five-year veteran teacher when I was a first-year teacher, I was like, wow, 5 years. It's a long time. Now, in this room, there's some of you that I actually have taught, some I've taught with, right? None of them have taught me, I don't think anymore, but there used to be. But anyway, that's something I want you to consider as well. To start out, I'd like you to take a look at this picture and consider the Bible in the picture. And I don't want you to raise your hand because I'm not trying to set you up for this, but in terms of almost a rhetorical question, how common would this scene be at your school with a student a kid sitting somewhere and just by choice reading their Bible. It's becoming less and less and less common in culture. And I actually chose one with the actual Bible, not the Bible app, right? Because we don't, that's a whole other sectional. But how common is it? Well, I'll give you some data. We survey our kids at Unity Christian quite a bit. And what we found out is that over the last 10 years, trending gradually, our amount of personal devotions that our kids actually do is gradually declining. To right now, and we're trying to figure out how to address this in a way that actually would work, but we're at about 87, 86% of our kids do not do regular devotions at all, right? So about 13, 14% do. Now that's in a Christian school, right? And they say, well, is Unity like an anomaly? You got a real problem over there? I don't think so. I think it's just a cultural issue that we don't read the Bible very much anymore. So if that is true, and I believe it is, like what impact does that have on how our kids understand things? Because they're not looking through the manual very much in their own lives. And that's true culturally, not just them, but it's a cultural thing as well. So maybe spin that around a little bit as we talk about some of these things too. So this is about social media, and we're going to talk about that. These are the five most used social media platforms for 9 to 12. I'm assuming most of you know each one of these by the logo. And I can tell you which one isn't the most used. It's the one in the middle, right? That's for the moms. So to campaign for, something, or to stay in touch, or whatever, or the grandmas. Not the kids. They have it, but they don't really use it. So, of the five, how many of you are pretty sure you know which one is the most used amongst kids?
Snapchat.
Okay, let's just try this out. Does anybody think it's Instagram? 9 to 12, right? Anybody think it's Twitter? Does anybody think it's Snapchat? Does anybody think it's YouTube? Okay, well, there's a group of you who are right. Which one is it? Well, for a long time, nothing's a long time in social media, for a while, it was Snapchat. Not anymore. YouTube. By a long shot, actually. YouTube is far outpacing Snapchat now for high schoolers. They still use Snapchat, it's not gone, but about 20% more kids use YouTube several times a day than use Snapchat. That's the cycle of social media things come and go. Remember MySpace? Way back Zanga, some of those kind of things, right? So these are things that kids use on the regular other than Facebook, right? Twitter is actually number 4, number 3, number 2, number 1 in that order. Okay, so that's not just a Christian school thing, that's just a high school, a 9 to 12 American thing. A couple of resources I want you just to be aware of. I did bring these along. One time I did a thing at CA, I brought some stuff along, and somebody took it all. So these are not to take. They're not gifts. But this book, I have the picture up here. This is from the Barna Institute, and I am a huge fan of what Barna does. They study culture carefully. They really also take a look at Christian culture. And if you're into culture watching, and if you're into like what's happening in our culture, Barna is an absolute must for you. And this is just called Gen Z. Okay, again, there's a whole bunch of resources that Barna Institute offers. Another one is one that is really quite new. It just came out in September, so just a month ago. I'm Dutch, so I'm not really sure how to say that last name. It doesn't end with Stra. So I think Twinge? I'm not really sure. But I have heard her speak. I've read her books. She's got more than a few. She's really, really smart, really, really good writer, and she does a ton of research. And her whole thing is generational research and what's happening in trends. So I trust what she has done because she tells you how she does it, and it's all very well sourced. So that's another thing that I'll be referring to quite a bit today as well. Another phrase, if you have a connection to Unity, you've heard me say this many times, like good grief, the fish again. But if you have never heard it before, this is from an old proverb, not from the Bible, which is if you want to understand water, and some of you probably actually know the rest of it, or maybe not. If you want to understand water, don't ask the fish. Because, you ask that in class, why would you not ask the fish? And some smart aleck, because fish can't talk. know, that's a very funny thing. Right? But the reason is because a fish does not understand what it means to be wet. Right? Because all they've ever known is water. So you understand wet because you've both been dry and wet. So wet has a meaning to you. Fish does not know that. So why? What does that have to do with anything? Well, the reason I'm putting that up there is because there's a strong tendency sometimes to understand, try to understand somebody else or someone else's position only from your position. So you really can't see it from their point of view. So you're not really understanding how it is that they're dry and you're wet, right? So I'm asking us today to step outside of our generation, maybe, to look at a generation that could be quite different from us and say, well, I don't get these kids today. Ever hear that expression from some people? Kids these days. You know, that kind of thing. Who usually says that? Older people. Actually, it's not the really older. That's a really bad thing to say. It's not the elders. It is more the older middle-agers that are more likely to say, kids these days. And they have something negative. Not kids these days. They're great. You know, you don't usually hear that. Right? So we're going to try to not be the fish today. All right, a couple things. What's in a name? We're going to try to just make sure we're on the same page generationally here. You can probably look at this a few different ways. And the numbers could be a little different depending on who you're reading and how you follow this. But just so we're kind of on the same page. First of all, the elders, or what's called sometimes the silent generation, about 1925, 1945. Do any of you have a staff member in your school who was part of the elder silent generation? One. Okay. We have one at Unity. He's a volunteer. He's 83. He's there part-time. And he's the smartest man I've ever met in my life. All right? And if you're wondering why they call it the silent generation, that's the name given to them as a descriptor. Because the thought was that they had to work so much, and life was not easy. They had no time to complain. They just went to work, right? They're the people who walked uphill both ways, and you know, didn't have shoes and didn't complain, right? Stuff like that. And they also, according to Tom Brokaw, became the greatest generation. That's the same group, right? Next one, baby boomers. Without naming it specifically, how many baby boomers are in this room? That's born between 46 and 64. All right, so you are the generation that came about after World War II. America prospered during that time, and you built a lot of America eventually, okay, once you grew up. And that was a changing, a very big and important generation in American culture. Then you got this group, the baby busters. Busters because birth rates went down significantly in this generation, and some problems went up. I am part of Gen X. How many of you are Gen Xers in here? Okay, so that's when we were born, and as you would probably recognize as well, the prosperity of some of the times of the baby boomers was dialed back a little bit, and we got a little bitter. Okay, we were known for being a little bit upset and angry, and our music reflected that. So if you remember the 90s and some of the music that was popular, there's a style called grunge music from the 90s, Nirvana, right? Some of you are like, oh yeah, Nirvana, right? TV. That was us. And then you have these folks, the Gen Ys or the Millennials. How many Millennials? That was the biggest crowd last time too, right? Last this morning session. You guys are narcissistic and entitled. Just so you know. Right? That is what you are known for. But you are also the generation that was the 9/11 generation. So unlike the baby busters and Gen X, who really never had a war to fight, the baby boomers did, Vietnam, Korea. We did not, right? The war on terrorism is a Gen Y and a millennial issue, right? So it's a trait of that generation. It shaped parts of who they became. Then you have Gen Z, right? Or as they are often called, iGen. And probably you can figure out why they're called iGen. And if you notice, about when they start 1995, and some of you may recall that in 1995, that's when Al Gore invented the internet, right? 1995. So, the internet and what came after it, all that stuff, is 1995 and following. So those kids are a product of that. So, that's kind of a place to start from. And one thing I'll point out is that typically with generations, if you study trends tend to go like the stock market. Where you can have from day to day, you know, ups and downs and changes, But if you look big picture, you see gradual trends, and the stock market usually trends over time upward. Well, that's true in generational study as well, where things trend either down or they trend up, but it's usually big picture quite gradual. It seems to be that with iGen or Gen Z, that the trending is more significantly stark, like it's shooting up or dropping off, more so on the same questions or the same issues than in the four previous generations. So the question you got to ask is, why would that be? How come it's so much different with some things with this generation? And what many people propose is that the technology that came with iGen is so different from what the other generations had to deal with that brought other changes with it that were sometimes unforeseen or unintended. And we'll talk about that a little bit as well as it relates to school. All right, time for a little, see what we know here. True or false, right? True or false, more high school seniors have a driver's license today than seniors in Gen X. How many would say true? How many would say false? You are definitely right on that. In 1972, nearly every graduate of 1972 had a driver's license. 72% of graduates from the year 2016 had a driver's license. So over 25% did not. Now I know this a little more at home because there's open house season for seniors. That's a little bit of a thing in Hudsonville, kids going to open houses. It's not uncommon to see a parent driving their son or daughter to an open house, letting them get out, they hang out there for a while, and the parent just waits in the car. And then they get back in and take him to the next one. Would your parents have done that? Probably not, right? So there's a reason why that is, not just because the kids don't care. There's reasons behind it. We'll get into some of this a little bit as well. Number two, fewer high school seniors have a job today than in any previous generation. That is true. Okay, fewer kids, by far, today are working than in previous generations. In fact, how many of you had a part-time job in high school? Okay, if you want, you can ask your seniors this, but right now, 44% of seniors in high school do not have a job. In 1972, less than 20% didn't have a job. Right, so the numbers are changing. Number three, high school students spend more time on homework now than ever. Would you trend true or not? Would you trend false? You're not sure about this. Here's what you have to kind of keep in mind. Again, you're looking generationally, not just the kids in your classroom or the kids in your house. How many of you have AP courses in your school? Most of you? Okay, so if you have AP courses, well, a lot of hard classes. However, overall, the kids are spending far less time on homework than previous generations. I graduated in 1987. From 1987 till now, kids spend on average a day 30 minutes less per day on homework than they did in 1987. Right? So they're busy, but they're not necessarily busy with homework. Right? So I'll give you a little stat that goes with it. You take homework, you take your job or paid work, you take volunteering and extracurricular activities. Kids today, the generation, your children specifically, on those things, homework, paid work, volunteering, extracurricular, 4 hours less per week than 1987 grads. So what are they doing then with the extra 4 hours per week? We'll see in just a minute. More high school students drink alcohol than the previous generations. Correct. It is false, right? Far fewer. And that's an issue, not of like, oh, this is, we realized this was a problem. It's more an issue of safety. Safety is a thing for Gen Z or iGen, and they realize that's a problem. It's going to make me unsafe, and things could happen, and what have happened. However, there's sort of a downside to this. High school numbers are dropping off significantly. What is actually rising, though, is college numbers, right? So our kids in high school go from 0 to 60 very quickly, because binge drinking numbers in college actually are going up. So that's a problem. Right? Because now, not that we want to train them to drink well in high school, that's not the point. But they're literally going through a huge transition. And if there's not a lot of guidance along the way for them on how to do this, that can be an issue for them. Number five, Gen Z experiments with fewer drugs than Gen X or millennials. It's actually true. But there are two exceptions to that. Cigarettes? Nope. Good guess. Vaping and pot. Because vaping and pot are seen as safe. Right? Because the legalization of marijuana is a big thing in a lot of places now. It's seen as a safe thing. Vaping is seen as not a harmful thing. A safe alternative to cigarettes. Right? So, safety. Number six, students today are more resilient than in previous generations. Yes, you are correct. That is false. And again, I know I'm a parent of four kids. Many of you are parents in here, so I'm saying this with all due respect to all of us as parents. Some of this, much of this at times, lies on the parent, not the student, right? And there's a phrase that you have heard for a long, long time called helicopter parenting. Well, many of you know this, that has transitioned into lawnmower parenting, right? Where now the parents are mowing the way down of any obstacles for their kids to encounter so that there's nothing they have to worry about for themselves. I will remove any barriers from your life. You are special, and I will make sure that you are. If you haven't ever heard it, listen to the 2012 graduation speech. It's all over online. You're not special. That was the title of the graduation speech that was given to a graduating class. You're not special. And the guy became famous. He wrote a book. Right? So, but, yeah, they have a harder time because the way has been paved in some ways for them that they can't bounce back. College counselors are dealing with this in a very significant way. When they get a bad grade and their parent can't fix it by calling the professor, they can't deal with it. Now, I say they, not all of them. This is averages and trends. Right? So kind of keep that in mind as well. So more teens are having sex in Gen Z than in Gen X. False. That's also a safety issue. And there's more worry and fear of assault. Okay, the Me Too movement has an impact on that as well. Okay? And then the last one, Gen Z is the most tolerant generation in the history of American culture. True. Definitely true. I'll give you just one example of how that shows up in a very open way, maybe different from your generation. LGBTQ, right? Many people in your generation had very little tolerance for even a conversation about that. iGen has a huge tolerance for that conversation. 66% of iGen teenagers see nothing wrong with any of the letters in LGBTQ in terms of behavior, identity, lifestyle, nothing, 66%. So that is different from your generation. And the one thing they see as intolerant, as a general rule, is the church. Right? The church is actually intolerant. So those are just a few little factoids about this generation. So who are these kids? What are they all about? Well, they're digital natives. They grew up knowing nothing other than technology. And I'm sure if you're 35 or older, you're probably going to have your students set your phone up quicker than you can set it up yourself, right? Because we, I'm one of these. I had my own son set up my phone. I was like, what are you doing? He's like, I'll take care of it. Said, okay, it's fine. Just go. I don't know what I'm doing. So the phone is the single biggest factor in iGen. Now, again, I'm not at all about knocking on, bashing on the phone, not in any way, shape, or form, but it has altered the way kids grow up, with the access that they have, with what they can know, and what they can do with it, is unbelievably powerful. And there are more movements in Christian schools now to have people kind of rethink, like, what should we be doing about getting our kids smartphones? At what age? When is it appropriate? You know, there's a movement of not, don't give them anything, but at least till 8th grade. Some people would say 16. The argument against that, I mean, you've heard this, well, how am I supposed to get a hold of them? You don't need a smartphone for that, right? I think most of you still have an office in your school, too. That may be fine. I don't know, maybe you don't. One thing that also is maybe a little different is just the way how the phone has actually affected the way we live life. If you were going to high school in the 70s, and you had your senior portrait taken for graduation that went in the yearbook, right? How many people from the 1970s went around school handing out their picture? Nobody, right? Well, now you go pre-cell phone, you get into the 80s and 90s, a little bit more of the narcissism and culture comes through. Now you have all a bunch of senior pictures and multiple poses, and you come to school with your Ziploc bag, okay, with your multiple different poses and outfits, and you hand them out to a number of people who will keep them. and you get to the 90s and the early 2000s, okay, before all this is really sort of a thing, and you got senior pictures all up and down your locker, okay? They're hanging in the locker, all these, and you just give them to people now because, you know, you have them, you give them away. Do you ever see senior pictures given out at your school anymore? No, they don't do it at all in our school. I don't ever see them. They have them sometimes on your graduation, your open house announcement, because they're all on their phone. Everything's there, right? And they're all, they have many, many of their selfies and their friends up. It's a Snapchat world. So to them, sending someone a picture of themselves is so normal. If you were in high school in the mid-1980s and you said to your guy friends, "Hey, here's a picture of me." It's going to be a punch in the face. So that's just one little example of how things have changed. So as a result, new media usage, how kids use their new media, 6 hours a day is average. Okay, so that's right down the middle. That's not including anything with schoolwork. And if you want to break down on that, that's about 2.25 hours a day of texting and direct messaging. Okay, give or take. 2 hours a day or so online. Again, this is not for homework or whatever. An hour and a half of gaming, give or take, and the most popular game right now, most of you are doing this. And does anybody happen to know the next most popular one? It's quite a bit less popular, but... No, well, it depends on what age you teach. I'm in high school, so it's Player Unknown's Battleground. PUBG. So everybody heard that before. And yeah, maybe Candy Crush or Minecraft is still pretty big in the middle school crowd too. So, and in 30 minutes on video chat, mostly FaceTime or Skype with most of our kids. Right? So what impact does this actually have? And a few things I want to get to you in terms of just to think about. One is, how does it impact, how has the digital age and iGen affected the way we do friendship now? I don't know if you have perceived any differences or not in your school, but I'm going to guess. I don't know your school specifically. I'll base it off of mine. You don't have nearly, if you're especially 50 or older, you don't have the fighting in school that you used to have, the physical throwdowns that you used to have. Kids don't fight that way anymore. Rarely do they do that. I'm going to meet out back, and we're going to throw down after school, right? Now it's all digital, right? That's how they fight, girls and boys. And so friendship has changed a little bit as well. Today, our iGen teenagers are spending, on average, 30 minutes a day less with their friends in person. Now, that's not including school. So they're 30 minutes a day less than they used to. So if you go back a number of years, 4 hours less a week than they spent in the early 1990s with their friends outside of school. 4 hours less. Now, does that mean they don't have any friends? No, I said in person. So their friendships now are very, very digital. Right? So they're video chatting or direct messaging or texting or whatever, Snapchatting, that's how they maintain their friendships. And if you're like, that's weird, how does that actually play itself out to how they relate? Well, if you're a high schooler and you can drive, you probably have actually seen this before if you have kids at home. You get invited to go somewhere. Okay, I'll pick you up in half an hour. Okay, so you get ready, kid gets ready, and they're waiting, and all of a sudden they just leave the house. Oh, because their friend drove up and texted them from the driveway that they're there. Right? They didn't come to the door and ring the doorbell. That interaction is gone for a lot of kids. It's easier to just tell you I'm here so I don't have to come in. So my son, who is now in college, he had a girlfriend in high school, and we said, well, we won't meet her. I actually knew her already. She's in our school. Unfair. Anyway, so I wanted my wife to meet her. But you tell her, I want to have her come in. I want to meet her. Well, he was like, well, this is weird. we asked her to do it. So she came over, and I think she had texted her son that he was, there. But he didn't go to meet her. I don't know why. But he didn't. And you can tell she didn't really know what to do. Like, do I knock on the door? Do I ring the door? So she just walked in. Walked in the house. We were like, hey. You can tell she was really uncomfortable. Like, here I am. I've never actually gone to a door before. Right? So the only time I do it is trick or treating. So it's affected friendship and the ways where the kids relate to each other.
if you've ever seen this and you're going to put it in your schools, right? Now, I'll give kids credit, and this is not a knock on kids thing. We're just being realistic about what's actually happening. Kids are smart, and they know, too, that some of the stuff, well, this is going to change. They get that, totally. So there was a group of kids last year at our school that, when they went out together, whether it was all guys or guys and girls or all girls, it was a big group of kids that when they went out somewhere, they put the phones in the middle, on the counter, and no one could touch them. Or if they go out to a restaurant, they put them in the middle of the table. First person to pick up their phone pays. Right? If you do that with a bunch of Dutchmen, you got dropped. That's what they ended up doing. So they are figuring some of this stuff out, too, for sure. Mental health. We could spend an hour on this alone, but I think most of you are familiar with the statistics that mental health is becoming a bigger and bigger issue. One of the bigger issues in mental health is loneliness. So 8th graders today are 31% more likely to call themselves lonely than they were just 5 years ago, right? And those numbers increase as the kids get a little bit older. Depression, suicide rates, most of you have heard this, are at an all-time high. One of the more popular, well actually it's the most popular from middle school to high school shows on Netflix. Anybody know? Yeah, you heard of 13 Reasons Why. It really resonates with high school. It's rather quite graphic. I don't really recommend it for middle schoolers at all. Even high schoolers, I'm nervous about that. But it resonates with them in terms of this idea of depression and anxiety, and they can't deal with people, and it's really a problem, right? So, related to mental health and friendship, just something you should be aware of, there's a new phobia that is a real thing called nomophobia, if you've ever heard of that before. Nomophobia is the fear of losing my phone. And that gives me anxiety, stress, and it makes me feel really, really out of control. 1 in 10 high school kids say they would rather lose a finger than lose your phone. Right? I found that fascinating. I asked my own seniors, so I just said that 1 in 10 kids would rather lose their fingers than their phone. Right? No way. You know, I would. You know, whatever. You get all kinds of different responses. But that's just something, again, that's part of what's changing right now. And I'll say this carefully, because you have to be careful with these things and you don't overhear them. But a very large study was part of this book here that associated loneliness and happiness with teenagers and social media. And what they found is that the greater the use of social media, loneliness increased along with that increase in usage. The decrease in use of social media increased happiness with the amount of decrease in social media use that was there. So it's a very, very clear correlation that increased social media use causes loneliness, decreased social media use causes happiness, right? Or results in happiness. So there's something there that kids are starting to see a little bit as well. They're not dumb. They're smart to see some of that once they start hearing about it. Empathy. Another one. Are your kids more compassionate today than they were a generation ago? Well, that's a tough one. I would really recommend, if you have time to do it, that you take a look at this book. I didn't bring it here today, but it's a really, really good book. And the author of this book, Michelle Borba, she advocates for the fact that our kids are losing the ability to feel for other people. And she says that, she claims that the use of technology distances our kids from real world issues and makes them hard to them, or concerned in a very non-really, I don't want to do anything about this. In fact, she didn't come up with this, but there's a term some of you have heard of called slacktivism. And slacktivism is caring enough to retweet something, or caring enough to like something, but not caring enough to actually do something about it. Right? It's called slacktivism. So a GoFundMe page is like, oh, that guy needs money for something. That's too bad. He's having a hard time. Not actually doing something. Wearing a ribbon for a cause, but not actually doing anything about it. Remember the ice bucket challenge from a few years back? Right? Maybe some of you did it. That actually worked quite well as a way to generate some awareness of and money. But if the only thing you ever did was dump a bucket of water over your head, then that would be a definition of slacktivism. I'll do something, but not really anything that big important. We have a harder time getting kids to actually commit to go doing service in high school than we used to. It's becoming more difficult. So that's one thing that she talks about quite a bit in that book. So that's another thing, is empathy. And then another one, too much too soon. This is something that when I talk about pornography at different schools and churches, the smartphone has allowed our kids, in many cases still, unfiltered access to the world that they cannot process. They just cannot. And their brains are not equipped for that. And I regularly use my example of fifth grade myself. When I went to a friend's house, he took me to his fort that was back in the woods. We crawled up in his treehouse, and in that treehouse was an old cardboard box that he had. He said, "Hey, look in here." And in there was a Playboy magazine he had found in a trash can at a car wash. And it was the first time I'd ever even heard of it or seen it. So he showed me and I looked at it. I was like, I didn't know really what I was looking at, but somehow in my Calvinistic blood, I knew it was wrong. Right? And I remember to this day, that was a magazine that was pretty much, you could hardly see half of it because it was all wrecked up and ruined. And I was a fifth grader. Well, that's nothing compared to what kids have access to today, and much, much more. Right? Now, that's just one thing. In the hypersexuality, you take all the other issues, but they don't have a filter to process. It's way too much, way too soon. The reason I have the potter glass blower, potter on a potter's wheel, or a glass blower blowing through that tube, our kids yet, in high school too, they're still in that formational stage. The glass is not hard, the pottery is not set, and they're still being formed. And the access they have is becoming part of that forming process in their lives, how they see the world through the lens of their experiences. So when those two things collide, culture that they're in and the generation they're growing up in, it also impacts your faith. And there's a new understanding of faith in life for our younger people. And we could talk for a long time about this as well, but there's just a few things I'd like to have you consider with this. One of those is how kids today, and again, not your kids, but in the general, as a generation, how they perceive religion and church. One thing I'd like to point out to my Unity community families, and I'm speaking for Unity now. I can't speak for the Chicago area schools or Wisconsin schools or whatever, but at Unity, I always say we, in terms of our community, what you see as national trends with young people, we usually lag about a quarter of a generation behind. And the stuff that you see when you go to Detroit in a public school, maybe, is not what you're going to see at Unity Christian. But we're coming along eventually, right? So maybe the things that they were dealing with really particularly 5-7 years ago, now we're dealing with that stuff, right? And so just because of the nature of Christian schools and churches and parents that are involved, we tend to lag a little bit on some of those trends. That's what I have witnessed personally in my school. Maybe yours is completely different than that. I wouldn't, want to say for sure in yours. But religion. It is said to be, again, generationally, this is going to be the least religious generation in the history of America, is iGen. One of the things they are skeptical of, in terms of their lives, is church. And so fewer of them go to church than ever before. I know many of you live in areas that feels like our church is growing. But again, that's from your perspective. We're talking generationally, how things are not going that way. I'll just read you a couple of statistics on this. First of all, more kids are being raised in non-religious families. So it's not just a kid thing saying we're checking out. Many of the families are checking out too. In our Christian school, we have more families now that don't really go to church, even though they profess to believe, than we've ever really had in a Christian school. So 1 in 6 eighth graders today professes no belief in anything. Nothing. 1 in 5 tenth graders professes that. 1 in 4 12th graders professes that, and 1 in 3 college students professes that. No belief in anything. Back in the early 2000s, there was an expression called SBNR, spiritual but not religious, right? Now that has changed to not spiritual, not religious. And so they're just whatever. And you have powerful voices like Bill Maher and pop culture who are parading that stuff out there. This is a joke, it's ridiculous, it's don't follow it, like, what are you thinking? Those voices start to matter after a little while. So what is the position of the Christian school when that is a strong cultural current that you hear? The anti-religious movement, if you will. So that's one thing, is their view of religion and church is definitely different than it was. Second, because of the culture, our understanding of sex and marriage, this is really an opportunity to talk, have a really good conversation with kids But the culture is changing the definition of sex and marriage in a fairly significant way. One of the things that you have to know, and I'll start over here with some marriage information. Maybe you know this, and maybe you've never heard before, but marriage rates right now are dropping. And they're said to be at an all-time low, right? And that's going to continue. So fewer iGeners will marry than in any previous generation. The average age of first marriage actually is going up. It's 27 and 29 right now in America. So your high school seniors could be 10 to 12 years away from their first marriage. Some of their great-grandparents were married at their age, right? And so now I'm not advocating that. Don't get me wrong. I do pre-marriage counseling. I'm not advocating teenage marriage. That's a very, very big difference from the way it used to be in terms of that. So if you go on a college campus now, the term that was considered very offensive, and it still is, if you kind of slept around in college, you call it slut, right? That's a common term. Everyone here has heard that before. That's not the worst thing you can be called in college now. The worst thing you can be called in college is desperate. Like you're looking for a man, right? Like you want to make sure you get married. Now, if you go even a generation ago, Calvin College for a long time had this sort of half joke and half true thing of girls go to Calvin to get their what?
Yes,
exactly. And that's okay. That's really actually fine. Well, where else are you going to go to find a person like that at Calvin or Dort or Trinity or whatever, right? But that is certainly something that is changing. Dating is seen as different as well. So if you're not going to commit because you don't really want to, and it's seen, well, part of the reason our iGeners are not committing is because they're looking at something else, which is divorce rates, 50%. I don't want to do this if half the people who get married split up anyway. I don't do that, so forget it. But what, they're still people, they're still human beings, so they're still interested in sex. So what does that lead to? Well, a changing definition of how you see that. So Tinder is a social media dating app, basically, that is for, more or less, sex hookups. Now, it's not really popular in high school, because high school kids know that, right, safety. But it changes when they get a little bit older. So that's, again, a little bit of a changing definition for how they see something as specific as sex. One other thing, I'm just looking at this today here, 36% of iGen babies are born to single moms. That also has an impact, right? 36%. So, ironically, they are afraid a little bit of sex as high schoolers because they see it as not being safe. It's a very ironic thing. There was a TV show that was on in the early 2000s that actually had an impact on that. Teenage birth rates. Teen mom, 16 and pregnant. MTV actually reduced teenage pregnancy. Right? Next one. Sexuality. Changing understanding of sexuality. Maybe combined a little bit with number two. But sexuality is how we define our understandings of sexuality and sex. Sex is just having sex, and that's how I split those up when I talk about this in class as well. So as I said, LGBTQ issues, 66% of our high school kids today have no issue with that whatsoever. I'll give you a little flashback here. 1998, a TV show came on that became very popular called Will and Grace. Right? Now, many of you know that also got rebooted last year, and so now it's on again. And if you watch both of them, you know this one's a little more aggressive, the new one, than the old one used to be. Because they couldn't do that back in 1988. Well, it didn't take too much longer than a cable in the early 2000s, a show came on called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. Right? That was a cable show. Five gay men who actually worked with a heterosexual man to make him appealing to a heterosexual female. An interesting concept. Right? Now that's back on again as well, in a different way. Then you had Glee. And that Glee was a groundbreaking show because it had high school age kids questioning sexuality for the first time. Glee really, really made a big impact on kids. And then later you had something like Modern Family. And the title is not coincidental, right? And most of us have watched it because it's honestly pretty funny, right? But it subtly, it also changes the way we understand and our attitudes. It's kind of hard to hate the people in Modern Family. And that's good. But does it change over the way we perceive the whole thing as well? And if there's no filter for understanding, then you are left to sort of filter for yourself. Right? Now, I do want to ask you to consider this. And again, I always say this to my kids. You have to be careful with information because you can take it in so many different ways. But just be aware. When you're talking about a changing shift in attitude, how much does that change and shift in attitude actually change behaviors that you yourself have or that you practice? So, for example, we talk a lot at our school about like LGBTQ issues. And what is it, people who are gay, people who are lesbian, what is it they deal with? You know, can you be born this way? Is it something that is a result of, you know, genetics? What's happening? I have those conversations. But does it actually influence behaviors over time? Well, let me just read you a statistic. In culture right now, as long as here, these young women who have sex with at least one woman has tripled since 1990. Now, you have to ask yourself the question, why would that be? Because there's just that many more actually lesbian women, or because we're being influenced by the culture? I don't have the answer. I'm asking the question. If I had the answer, I'd tell it to you. For men, it's double. Okay, so not just women, but it's double for men. There may be a reason why for women it's greater, because, and this sounds a little crude, but for a lot of heterosexual men, lesbian sex, in terms of pornography, is actually a turn-on, and they have a hatred for homosexual sex between men. It's a massive double standard that I point out to my kids all the time. You cannot look at these as being different. They're not, right? Another one that you should just be aware of, bisexual experiences for people under 30 have tripled from 1990 to 2016. So much so that on college campuses now there are three terms that you should be aware of. Bug, lug, and hasbian. Right? Bug is bisexual until graduation. Lug is lesbian until graduation. And hasbian is I'm a lesbian until I get a husband. Right? Cultural terms. Now that indicates, not really this, but I'm just experimenting with this. So they see sexuality as being fluid. So you can kind of morph in and out, back and forth, whatever. A newer thing with transgenderism, which is something that we're trying to understand more, is that there's something called rapid onset gender dysphoria. Rapid onset means that you have a middle school boy or girl, and within 2 days, sometimes, they decide, I actually think I'm a girl now. That's rapid onset. That's not a pattern that you see, because kids who oftentimes really struggle with their sexual identity, you can notice things when they're children in some cases. These are kids who have no indicators all the way through until a certain, all of a sudden, I think I'm actually a boy. And many of those kids then morph back into what they were before they decided they were something different, right? So how does culture influence behaviors? That's something, again, that's very different from this generation. And then another thing is tolerance. And the fear of offending. We already said this is the most tolerant generation, but there's a very, very big tendency to, the worst thing you can call a high school senior is judgmental, right? You do not want to be perceived as judgmental. That's awful. So you'll do a lot of stuff to make sure you don't offend somebody. That has killed, in some cases, classroom conversation, because kids don't want to say what they really think because they're worried that someone's going to be offended by it. And I always tell them, you're seniors in high school. You shouldn't worry about offending someone if you're saying something in a loving way. Say what you believe. And along with that, the fear of embarrassment as well. I used to do an activity in a class where I had the kids do something. You had to physically get up in front and they had to do a physical thing. And 10, 15 years ago, this is one of the things I've done for a long time just because I kind of wanted to see how it went as well. I'd have 15, 20 kids who wanted to try this. I don't do that activity anymore because I can't get anybody to do it. They don't want to do it because they're afraid that they're going to get judged or made fun of. Someone might video it and put it out there. I ain't taking that kind of chance, right? So that kind of goes, that's not really tolerance or fear of offending, but it kind of sometimes goes with it as well. On college campuses, there's such a fear of this that we are gaining ground on social justice causes, but losing ground on free speech issues. And so you should have a little bit of both. So much so that there's something now on college campus, not high school hopefully yet, called safe spaces, where if you're offended as a college student, you literally go to this place that's a safe space and you can color, I'm not kidding, you can color, you can draw mazes, because it's a decompression zone if you feel offended. Now, what kind of thing drives a kid to a safe space? Well, at Oklahoma Wesleyan University, to Christian College, the president gave a chapel, basically, on 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter in the Bible. After the chapel, a student came up to him and said, I'm deeply offended by your chapel. He said, why? Because you told me your chapel made me feel like I'm not good enough. I don't love more as much as I should, and I don't like that. And I don't like that you made me feel bad that I don't love enough. And the guy's like, are you kidding me? And so he said, young man, this is college. This is not daycare. Go back to your room and grow up. Right? He literally said that to the kid. And then the kid had to go to the safe space because he couldn't deal with it at all. Right? Elections are very volatile, obviously. And at Emory University in 2016, a couple students went in three different spots on the campus and in chalk, okay, on the sideline, wrote Trump 2016. Now, there's no doubt people on that campus don't like Trump, but you see yard signs all over the place. Well, in this case, some kids wrote Trump 2016. Now, was it a dumb idea? Yeah, it was a dumb thing to do. But a group of students got together and protested. Okay, they actually formed a protest, signs and everything, and marched up to the president's home and said, you're not listening to us. And they kept yelling, we are in pain, we are in pain, from sidewalk chalk, right? Now, I don't know what your grandparents would have done about that, but again, we cannot be offensive. That's a generational difference brought about by some of these movements who are, don't say anything wrong. If you've ever heard of microaggressions before, microaggressions are very small things that you say that are perceived as being offensive. And on college campuses now, bigger ones, not the Calvins and Dorts and Trinities, but the number one microaggression thing you can ask somebody is where you are from. So do not ask someone where they're from. Because if you ask them where you're from and they actually tell you, then you fill in all your own prejudices and stereotypes, and it's a microaggression. To the point where that's like, are you kidding? But that's a product of kind of a woven culture that kind of goes along with this. And again, I would say this a little bit of the ongoing idea of just relativism or culture, whatever. Right? If you want to know, and I'll just keep this up here for a second, in my high school, every year survey my seniors and say, what is it that you're thinking about that you want answers to that doesn't make sense to you or you want to talk about? That list is growing a little bit every year, but that's the stuff you're saying the last couple of years right there. Okay, so if you want to know what they want to talk about, that's what's on their mind in high school. Right? So finally, just briefly, what do we do? We can't do everything, so how do you start? A few just quick suggestions. I believe strongly that in a Christian school, grade school, middle school, high school, we have to teach truth with a capital T, that there actually is something that is legitimately truth. There's a real heaven, there's a real hell, there's a real right and wrong, and we need to make decisions. And that is not really in vogue in many cases, but it's really, really true. And the schools, our schools are in a better position to do that, really, than our churches are. Because churches only see them once in a while. We see them every day. So, in fact, this book, the Gen Z book, I want to read you this one sentence from here. Actually, it's just a very short paragraph. He writes, and this is not a pro-Christian school kind of organization, but a cultural organization. Here's what they say. Engaged Christian teens, however, are a stark contrast to their peers on moral issues. We see significant gaps between their beliefs and all others, including church-going teens, on most moral issues, suggesting that church attendance alone does not create distinctive believers. Instead, only those teens who grow up with strong Christian education and intentional discipleship are taking the Bible's moral principles to heart, while others look more like the broader culture. Right? For such a time as this, for Christian schools, with that. Another thing is to actually teach judgment and discernment. It is okay to tell something, call something what it is. I give an example in my class, and I say, all right, you're on a plane ride back from a college visit, and it's just you, and you end up talking to someone next to you, and they're really nice and stuff, a nice conversation. You find out they are a person with a completely different religion than you. Right? So you start talking religion with them a little bit. At some point, after a while, you ask them, they ask you, so I understand that you're a Christian, and that I'm a blank, different religion. That person says to you, senior, do you think that my religion is wrong? And our kids do not want to say, I can't say that. That's no. Because you think it's rude? Well, it is kind of rude, isn't it? They asked you. You're not just holding a sign in the plane. They asked. They don't want to say it. So it is okay to speak truth in love when it's time to speak truth in love. And our kids, they can do it. I've seen it many, many times, but they have to be encouraged and enabled to do that as well. Maybe one of the harder ones, educate parents. We we are spending more time with our school community saying, we want to help you in your very hard job. Parents have a hard job too, and life is busy. The parents don't spend as much time because we're all busy. So their kids are off at practices and this and that, and they're not working alone as much. But the parents are busy too. And one person said to me once, I don't remember who it was, but we're only as effective as our parents allow us to be. And there's a degree of truth to that when it comes to our kids. And then fourthly, rethink educational practice, how our kids learn. This is a difficult one because it's just difficult. I'll give you an example of all. YouTube, which is the number one social media app, our kids today, the average length of YouTube video when they watch is 3 minutes long. That's the average length of the videos they watch. So, if we plop in a video that is 35 minutes long in class, unless it's really, really good, right? Someone once told me, the longer I talk, the better I have to be, because otherwise the kids are gone. And so some of the ways we think of doing education, maybe you have to think of as well. We have learned, I have learned in my role at Unity through failure. I'm trying to get the kids to read the Bible. I asked them just to take out their physical Bible and read it. It didn't happen. I have to rethink how I need to get kids to do this, what I need to draw them in. And then lastly, engage their world and inform yourself. And this is where you sort of, you're not the fish anymore. We step into this culture and say, what is it we have to know? What is it we have to learn? And there are a lot of resources. And I'll just quick flash a couple up here. One of them is this one. It's not Christian, but it's very, very good. Common Sense Media. I would tell every one of your parents to have it in your school as well. Another one, especially for older kids, is the Culture Translator. Teachers and parents, this is an awesome, awesome resource called the Culture Translator. And you get an email several sometimes each week that gives you, here's what's going on. And then this is another one I love. This is a very, very Christian one, and it's sort of secretly reformed without saying it, which is CPYU, or the Youth Culture Initiative. Well, you look really, really good as well. So if you have any questions, please feel free to ask. It's been a pleasure talking with you this afternoon, and thank you very much.